And welcome to Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. This is your host, Ryan Young. We have a great show for you today. We're going to start off with some music from the guitarist Roy Clark from the album The Lightning Fingers of Roy Clark. And this is 12th Street Rag. And that was 12th Street Rag by Roy Clark from the album The Lightning Fingers of Roy Clark. Welcome to Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. This is Ryan Young. Today we feature a talk by Monica Gagliano about plant intelligence and the importance of imagination in science. And this comes from Bioneers. And Bioneers, since 1990, has acted as a fertile hub of social and scientific innovators with practical and visionary solutions for the world's most pressing environmental and social challenges. I believe this was recorded at the 2018 National Bioneers Conference, and the introduction is by Kenny Osubel. And Monica Gagliano is the author of the book Thus Spoke the Plant, a remarkable journey of groundbreaking scientific discoveries and personal encounters with plants. And the foreword is by Suzanne Simard, who you might know from her Mother Tree book. So here she's going to explain some of the very innovative research she did with plants. And then at the same 2018 Bioneers Conference, she was on a panel with Michael Pollan, who has written many books, but one of his books that was related to this panel discussion was The Botany of Desire. And so it's a discussion led by J.P. Harpignies, who is a Bioneers senior producer. So enjoy this talk by Monica Gagliano and a portion of the panel discussion, which took place at the same conference with Michael Pollan.
Well, it's my pleasure to introduce our first keynote of the morning. 20-something years ago, here at Bioneers, the ethnobotanist and self-described plant person, Kathleen Harrison, described the worldviews of the indigenous shamans and plant people with whom she was working in the Amazon. She said this, "Everything is vibrantly alive in the same way we feel we are. Every single species has eyes with which it sees the world, and it sees as legitimate and true a version of the world as what we see. Every species has a song. It's part of an encyclopedia on the sonic level in the same way the seeds are on another level. As a species, it has a vast set of relationships to all the others in its world and to its ecosystem. These plants are allies to each other. They're also not allies. It's a net of species that are communicating, and we're each just beads on a net. In these traditions," Kathleen concluded, "the spirit resides in the species, and every species will speak to you in the same way from the same source. Take away your identifying mind and just see the spirit in the plants." Over the past 20 years, there's been a revolution in vegetal biology. Scientists are starting to talk like shamans, and shamans are starting to talk like scientists. Where previously science has regarded plants as inert mechanisms, research scientists are now proving in the lab what shamans have long observed. Plants are animated with intelligence and consciousness. They learn, remember, communicate, and have intentions. In fact, they do most of the things we associate with personhood. Monica Gagliano is a research scientist operating on the far frontiers of plant cognition to reveal them as sentient organisms. She's done so by combining the objectivity of the scientific method with the subjectivity of intuition and transcendental experience. Michael Pollan reported on Monica's rigorous research in The New Yorker, and Michael originally referred Monica to us. Monica believes she was born to be a scientist. As a girl, she grew up in the city. Her parents thought nature was dirty. You didn't touch nature and you kept it outside. But of course, she didn't. She started a journal tracking the growth of her bean plant and created her first data set at age 9. Monica's a research associate professor in evolutionary ecology at the University of Western Australia and a research affiliate at the Sydney Environment Institute at the University of Sydney. After studying animal behavior as an animal ecologist, she turned her attention to plant behavior. She's penned numerous groundbreaking scientific articles. She's co-editor of The Green Thread, Dialogues with the Vegetal World, and The Language of Plants, Science, Philosophy, and Literature. Monica's new book is Thus Spoke the Plant. She calls it a phytobiography, a collection of stories written with and on behalf of the plants themselves. She describes her imaginative experiments that opened the space to begin to understand how to make contact with this other than human intelligence, in its own language and on its own terms. Among other experiments, she's blazed the trail for a brand new field called plant bioacoustics, showing that plants do make sounds. Or, shamanically speaking, you might say, plants do have a song. Monica's illuminating the forefront of a new scientific paradigm. She recognizes and respects the other-than-human genius of nature. She dissolves our false separation between people and the natural world. She seeks to learn the languages of nature, and she quiets her identifying mind to see the spirit in the plants. Please join me in welcoming a plant person supreme, Monica Gagliano.
Okay, so first of all, I'd like to, you know, acknowledge the traditional owners, and also as I was listening to the welcoming ceremony, I just realized that I should also honor the indigeneity that lives inside me and inside every one of us, because we are all indigenous of this place. So I'm going to start with a little talk. It's actually a little anecdote of something that happened to me just a couple of weeks ago while I was in Brazil at a conference on plant physiology. And after the sort of introductory plenary talk, we had nibbles and drinks, and one of my colleagues, a philosopher, asked a very simple question to a group of us. And so I'm going to pose the same question that he asked here to you. And the question was, what killed the dinosaurs? And I'm sure that the first thing that comes to your mind, which is the same thing that comes to everyone's mind, is like, but of course it's the asteroid, right? And in fact, we know very well an asteroid collapsed onto our planet and put up this big dust of sand and dirt, and it covered the sun, and then, you know, it got really cold and everyone died. And in fact, you know, that's how the story goes. And in fact, we also know that at that particular time, it seems that many species disappeared. And so it kind of corroborates the idea that, well, there was one single cataclysmic event that kind of wiped everyone out, the asteroid. And then in 1978, in the peninsula of Yucatan, we found this huge crater. And so that was the cherry on top of the cake. He's like, well, that, you know, that's the asteroid. Now, of course, I'm not here to debate whether the asteroid that was charged with the killing of the dinosaurs really did a good job, did the job at all or not. But the reason for putting up this question, which was really the same reason why my colleague asked it at the conference, is that when you're asked to think of an alternative explanation that is not the story of the asteroid that you've been given since you were at school and before, possibly, we find it really hard to think of something else. It's just, but it is the asteroid. What else could it be? And so the point of this is that pretty much by the time you go to school, so by the time you turn 7 or thereabout, your imagination has been already stifled. And the ability, your actual ability to think of alternative possibilities is reduced dramatically. And so I'm going to talk about the role of imagination in the context of science, but it's just an example of what it really means in the wider picture, especially in the context of the wider picture that we are experiencing right now. So imagination, from the roots of the word, it basically means create images of something or representing something, representing the world. And of course, we all know how imagination touches and deeply moves us, especially when it's expressed through creative approaches that artists and musicians, for example, are really good at. And so what I find intriguing is that basically imagination is the creative ability of our mind to literally dream the world and worlds. And so it's a bit surprising that such a critical creative endeavor would be kind of dismissed when we talk about science. When we talk about science and you talk about imagination in science, the word takes a totally different meaning. And suddenly you're talking about like fanciful, you know, speculation of empty assumptions. Basically, they're telling you, what are you talking about? There is no such a thing. So there is either a tendency to kind of downplay the role of imagination in science or completely dismiss it from the important role that it has in the construction of knowledge through science. So I'm not here to, you know, lay judgment on science. But it is true, though, that our modern techno-scientific world has kind of subscribed to a arid version of imagination. And it's very different and very far away from what we know imagination is when we think about it as the creative beings that we are, because we are all artists, we are all musicians in some ways. So what I was interested in is like, well, when science, which is a strong voice in our culture still, when science describes a world that is kind of deprived of imagination, then you're describing the human and the rest of nature as a system of cogwheels. And suddenly those parts are easily to dispose of. They are, you know, replaceable. And in the worst cases, and we see this all the time, they become worthless. So again, as I said, I'm not here to pass judgment on science. I'm a scientist, I love science, and I think science is yet another amazing creative endeavor of the human experience. So what I'm interested in is how we actually got to stand in front of this door and why we are so scared, especially in science, to open it. Because I have my little theory. For me, the idea of imagination, of course, brings up like this feeling of unruly and out of control. And in a world that we say we feel increasingly unsafe, and we, as a counterpart, we feel like we need to control. The more we control, maybe we have the illusion that we will feel a little safer. But actually, maybe it doesn't work that way. And maybe, you know, we're standing in front of this door and we are so concerned that if we open it, we are going to unleash chaos. But in fact, maybe imagination can release those solutions that we are so desperately looking for, and we can't see them, just as we couldn't see an alternative to the asteroid for the dinosaurs, because we've been trained and conditioned to think that that's going to be chaos if you open the door. So I'm going to bring up one of the most impressive scientists of the most recent year, like decades, and of course is Darwin, which has guided a revolution of his own. And he recognized the role of imagination. Actually, probably many scientists wouldn't be able to do their job without it, whether they like it or not. And so Darwin recognized the imagination actually is a prerogative of the human. I corrected that. He said man, but... And not only that, I corrected again, I added a S. it's a faculty that allows us to actually create the brilliant and novel results or opportunities that we are all looking for. So, why imagination is so important and why it's actually not that difficult? Because it represents a reservoir of meaning. And this is a meaning that is embodied. It's in our flesh, it's in our blood, it's in our roots. and not only that, but it's like it's made of a pre-linguistic system. So we don't even need to talk. We have it. We can feel it through our emotional system. Our body knows it. So it's kind of like a birthright. How lucky is that? We're so desperate for solution, and the solution is right here, inscribed in the system itself. So pretty easy, right? But from a Darwinian perspective or from an evolutionary perspective, well, the reason why this information is so important is actually because it does guide action and adaptive behavior. So those are the solutions that we want, because another way to say this would be that is the innovative solution to the eco-cultural and also political issues that we're having at the moment. So the question would be like, okay, great, I'll subscribe to that. How do we open the door? And all I can offer, because I don't think that there is one solution for all I can offer is my experience as a scientist and also my own personal journey when I chose to open that door for myself, and also what it means when you can extrapolate from that smallest story of the individual to a bigger picture of a collective. So when I opened the door, I found two things. I found plants and indigenous knowledge. And of course, you probably know from the introduction that Kenny gave, I was studying animal behavior, and then I decided to switch on to plants, and that's a story of his own. And when I started looking at plants, I looked at plants from the context of plant in relation to sound. And that was totally inspired by my own experiences in the realm of indigenous knowledge, where this story has been recurrent everywhere. And so my role, I felt, was just to see whether science could actually test it. Isn't that what science does? It tests ideas. And of course, that in itself was scary enough, so that I had a couple of colleagues in my own corridor, in my own department, that couldn't bear saying hello to me for 2 years. I know. But that is just a small example of what it means, you know, how scary it is to actually open that door. But what do? We just open it anyway, right? So, and actually, then you get really good at it, and there's a little bit of audacity that kicks in. And so, oh, yeah, this is really disturbing. There must be something in here. I'm going to push even further. So I moved from just the communication of plants to something that it got perceived even more threatening, and that is like the entire area of the cognitive abilities of plants. And of course, learning and memory are under that umbrella. So I need to give a little story here again, because of course, research on learning and memory comes from the domain of psychology. So it comes from the study of the human cognition. And then in several decades later, we managed to move beyond the human and include some animals. And then more recently, even machines. But one thing that this entire field has been insisting on is the fact that neurons and brains are the key. And if you don't have them, you are automatically, a priori, excluded. Which, of course, when you actually then explore this, you realize that that's not true. But in order to do good science, you go and do your experiments. So the first plant that I worked with is Mimosa pudica, also known as the sensitive plant, because it moves really fast, literally at that speed, or even faster. And the reason why this plant has been loved forever, literally, there are records from the Roman time, Darwin was passionate about mimosa, and then you probably have known and seen about her from a beautiful article that Michael Pollan, which is somewhere around, wrote a few years ago for the New Yorker, where mimosa was featured, and Michael did a really good job at describing one of the experiments that I did with these plants, which included like dropping the plant and see whether the plants could learn to ignore me, basically. And it does. It learns really fast, and it remembers for a very long time. But I'm not going to go into mimosa, because I like to spend some time to talk about a kind of higher level of learning, which is from a pea, the nice, humble, green garden pea. Now, to understand what I did with the peas, we need to go back to the animal kingdom. And I'm sure that many of you are familiar with the Pavlovian study of the dog. So just to, you know, go briefly through it, Pavlov noticed that, of course, dogs salivate when they are about to receive their dinner, and they're getting very excited. And then he wanted to know whether he could kind of manipulate that behavior. So the salivation of the dog to dinner is instinctive. Dogs do it. So then he needed to find some neutral cue that he could use and see whether he could change that response. And he turned up with this bell. And so the story goes that whenever he rang the bell and then presented dinner, you know, the dog would salivate. And then, because the dog learns about the relationship between these two things, the bell and the dinner, and the fact that the bell predicts the arrival of dinner, then the bell on its own suddenly is producing the salivation of the dog. And so what is interesting about the experiment is the fact that, you know, first of all, the dog is evaluating what's going on in his environment, and he's got his own value system. So he's deciding what he wants, what is worthwhile, what is it going to help him to get there. Now, the next thing about this is that, of course, not all dogs are the same, and so this value system is very subjective. So there is a subject in there, and then that is making these decisions. And the decisions are made on feelings, depending on how the dog feels about having that dinner or that dinner and about this bell. It could be really annoying. But also by the experiences that are connected to those cues. Now, the really interesting thing about this experiment, from my perspective, is that, in a way, by salivating to the sound of a bell, which really, because it's predicting dinner, what the dog is showing us is that he's actually extending the amount of information that is in the environment. In other words, he's extending the information to something that is not in the environment, because dinner is actually not there. So food, or dinner in this case, is just a concept in the dog's mind. Or in other words, the dog is imagining dinner. Now, take this and let's apply it to a plant, exactly the same strategy. So dinner for the plant is blue light. And this response, the plants don't salivate, but not for as much as I know, but the blue light triggers a phototrophic response, which means that the plants will bend towards them. So that's what the plants want, just as much as the dog wanted dinner. Now, I had to find something that would replace the bell, and but would play the same role. And what I came up with was this little tiny fan, which on its own doesn't do anything to the plant. The plant actually doesn't really care. So it keeps growing straight, hoping for some light somewhere. Now, just as Pavlov did with the dog, if you present the fan, always anticipating the light, eventually the plants learn that actually, just by the fan, I can start preparing and turn towards it because the fan tells me where the light is going to be. So, of course, just like for the dog, there is someone in there who is making the decision and is based on a value system. How much do you want that light? What does the fan mean? And just like for the dog, not all plants are the same. And also, that subject in there is, you know, deciding and choosing based on how it feels about things and the experience of those things. Just like for the dog, the plant is actually stretching the field of perception because dinner, in this case the light, is actually not even there. So you know where I'm going. So just like the dog, the food is actually a concept, an idea in the plant's mind. Or, in other words, the plant is imagining the food arriving. So this, of course, was a great study. This was a great study because, you know, apart from the results, the scientific results, it was able to disrupt, you know, that linear thinking that, you know, if you don't have a brain and no neurons, you can't have this. And he says, no, it works some other ways. And so we had to relinquish that or at least expand it. And but the other thing that was good for me personally is that basically he showed me that imagination is everywhere, no matter what kind of mind or what kind of form you are. And so, in other words, it would be the same as saying that imagination is at the heart of nature, our own nature as the human form and any other nature. And equally, it's an important bridge between that heart and the mind that dreams the world into being, again, whether it's the human mind or not. Now, do you remember this door? We are stuck in front of this door, and we are so concerned that if we open it, we are going to unleash chaos. But guess what? By staying behind this door, which means we are staying stuck inside our minds, and we don't want to cross that bridge of the imagination that can link our mind to our heart, we are actually experiencing chaos. I'm sure everyone's seen the IPCC report from last week, and it's not exactly great news. But the good news is that we don't have to do this. It's just as easy as opening the door. All we need to do is there, so that that connection can be reestablished. It's already there. We just had to open the door to it. Now, again, just to finish, in my own personal life, when my mind, and I'm so happy that I have one, and my heart, and I'm so grateful that I have one, were linked together through the bridge of imagination, I discovered a few things. One, that it took me over those intellectual gaps that I was so afraid of, so the fear of opening this door. Two, that it has integrated what it looked paradoxical, what looked like discrepancy between what I knew and what was to come, the new. And then it allowed for the emergence of this new insight, new understanding, and inspiring ideas. And basically, it changed my life and my world as the individual. But it also showed me that it's absolutely, without a doubt, possible. We can do it, and we just need to dare. Thank you.
Anyway, so what we're going to try to do here is to have a scintillating conversation, obviously, but I think we're going to start off by talking about plant cognition and plants in general, because our two speakers here have a commonality in that Michael's book that came out a few years ago, The Botany of Desire, as he alluded to this morning, was really about the plant, the human relationship to several plants, to four plants in particular, from the plant's perspective. And of course, Monica is doing, has done groundbreaking work in plant cognition, including the field of plant bioacoustics, which she almost single-handedly put on the map. So I think that we'll start by the first question that, I want to delve into is, so we know that in the Western scientific tradition, in the last few hundred years, there's been this very hard attempt at a very hard dividing line between human consciousness and the rest of the natural world. Now, there's always been a countervailing trend in the sense that we have von Humboldt, who you mentioned, and Goethe, and, you know, in antiquity, a different feeling about plants, and Montaigne, the French philosopher. So, and there's an old tradition of panpsychism, this idea that consciousness permeates the universe. But all of that's been a minority trend. So we've had it by years, of course, you know, in the last few years. We have Paul Stamets, who talks about mycelial consciousness, and Jeremy Narby, who talks about intelligence in nature. And last year, Suzanne Simard, who discussed the families of trees and how trees share nutrients and so on. But by and large, the scientific community is still, as Monica knows well from her colleagues not speaking to her in the hallway, very strongly holding on to this view of the separation between human consciousness and the rest of the natural world. So the question I wonder is, do you think that your work in plant cognition and your changing perspectives about the role of plants will eventually change the concept of what it means to be human? Will we achieve a broader, more, you know, inclusive definition of consciousness? Or is there going to be savage resistance to that concept? And it'll be, as Niels Bohr said, which science changes one funeral at a time. So let's start with that, of how much you think these new, this work that you're doing and this, you know, these memes that you're spreading about plant consciousness are likely to have an effect on the view of what it means to be human, and how much resistance will we get to that?
Should I go first?
Yeah, go for it.
I don't know. I mean, to be perfectly honest. Patrolling the borders between our species and others is a really old and important thing humans feel the need to do. You know, you're constantly getting these definitions of we're the only species that X. And one by one, all the X's have fallen. And it's remarkable to watch that process and the retreat of what is distinctive to us that we suddenly discover animals can do also. So I think the general trend is toward recognizing more of a commonality. I'm not talking about plants yet. I'm just talking about animals. A growing recognition that we're on a continuum. There's not this quantum break between our capabilities, you know, whether it's tool making or language. You know, these were big dividing lines that have fallen one by one, and I'm guessing others will fall as well. And it's not surprising. I mean, we're part of the same world, you know. So extracting or abstracting humanity from nature just seems to be an obsession of ours. At least in the West, and I shouldn't generalize, but there are definitely cultures that don't have it. So I think people will work hard to patrol these borders. But I need to, you know, when we use a word like consciousness, though, we have to be really careful. There are many, many ways to define it, and it's easy to elide them and let them kind of slip together. Consciousness can mean something as simple as awareness of one's environment. And in that definition, you can imagine, and your work has shown, that plants have this awareness. They're responding in ways that aren't simply rote. And then the word intelligence, too. How do you define intelligence? So people bring their imagination of, and there's imagination, too, another word, to these words, But it's very important we agree on what they mean and what we're using. When you talk about human consciousness, we're usually talking about self-consciousness, a quality of self-reflection. And I don't know that you're ready to say that about plants. I mean, I'm not, but so we have to get all this, you know, clear. But if you define intelligence as the ability to solve novel problems, yeah, plants have it. But other people would define intelligence in another way.
You know, Jeremy Norby was pointing out that he was studying Japanese scientists who didn't work with slime mold as being able to solve problems, and that people got very uncomfortable when they used the word intelligence, but if they said smartness, then it was all okay. So, so I guess a lot is in the language, as you say. So, Monica, yeah.
And actually, it's intelligence is a good one because the word intelligence simply means, literally means choosing between. That's where the roots of the word comes from. So choosing between is a smart thing to do. and everything needs to choose between options of various kind, whether it's like, shall I go and get my water over there? Shall I open my leaves? Shall I crawl and get those nuts or not? Shall I mate with this one or that one? Which one is brighter? So all of these choices are intelligent in a way, because that's what the definition of the word is. But of course, I think that, and so intelligence become loaded as much as consciousness and other terms when we appropriate that. We colonize the words that we make and we give them a very specific definition in specific context. And when we do that, especially with words like consciousness, for example, it's true that we say, well, the definition of consciousness could be like that, you know, you're self-aware, self-conscious of who you are. But that in itself is it's a funny definition, because first of all, it means that I will never know. I can only know my own self-awareness, and I will never know really anybody else. So it's the quintessential separation, because I don't know what it means to be self-aware in your body, in your shoes, in your roots. And also, in that sense, it also means that I will never, by definition, I'm already excluding everything else from that, from being that. Like, the conversation is closed, because it's like, well, if I can only be aware of myself, barely, then that's it. There is nothing else to say. And so the concept, I think, fails, because words are, we're using words to describe the world. And if the words are failing us, well, the world is still there. Maybe we just need to choose different words or remove the loading. Open those words so that words are a medium to explore and investigate and learn and understand, appreciate, connect more rather than disconnect and be in a world of separation. So this is actually a very important conversation starter, because it highlights exactly the problem that I see in our, at least in the West, but in general as a planet, the problem that I see today is like is a world of separation, but that is also just a construction. The world has never been separate, you know, from the beginning to the end. It's never going to be like that. But if we are going to subscribe to that and we're going to use words to describe that and use our words to mark the separation, then, yeah, we are creating things as we see them now. And it doesn't look very pretty to me, so.
When I was writing the article that Monica talked about called The Intelligent Plant, being a good journalist, I went and found my skeptics, and I found all these, you know, prominent botanists who, on first flush, when they heard about plant consciousness, plant intelligence, were incredibly dismissive. And especially plant neurobiology, which was a very tendentious phrase that was used in the early days of this movement that Monica's involved with. But as I interviewed them, and I spent a lot of time with them, there was less disagreement than I thought once you started working on, well, what do we mean by intelligence? Let's see if we can get a common definition. What do we mean by consciousness or awareness? And a lot of the skepticism fell away. Not all of it, but it was there. It was less. I thought it was really going to be a black and white, you know, kind of a ping pong argument, but there was a convergence that I thought was very interesting and telling. On this point that Monica raised about separation, there is a quality of consciousness that is inescapably separating, and that is, of course, as you suggest, the subjective feeling of being you, which science can't penetrate yet, has no way to measure. We all take it on faith. And of course, we rely on something else you talked about this morning to overcome that, which is imagination. That's what novels help us do, right? They help us inhabit the consciousness of another. When you read something Monica's written or I've written, you're letting us occupy your consciousness to some extent, right? So humans have developed ways to bridge those gaps, but they're real and curious and big mysteries. But I think we should be very careful on how we use the word consciousness with regard to plants. I think if we mean awareness, I'm there totally. I think if we mean self-consciousness or that famous essay by Thomas Nagel on consciousness, what is it like to be a bat? If it is like anything to be a bat, in other words, if there's a quality to bat experience, bats have consciousness. I don't know, what is it like to be a mimosa? I don't know. I mean, this may be an essay in your future.
Well, there is a lot in there. It depends who is talking, I think. If you're asking the scientist, then the answer would be, I have no data to answer the question. So the question is unanswered, not unanswerable, it just is unanswered. If you're asking the person that has experienced plant at a, you know, in an intimate way, then you're right, there is no plant consciousness or human consciousness, there is only one consciousness, and what is residing here is residing there.
We'll get into, I think what we're starting to flirt with is the subjective experience that some of us have in altered states in which plants definitely seem to be speaking, you know, but we'll save that for a little later on, we'll get to that. But I think that the point you raised is a very interesting one about our sense of self, because that's so problematic. A tradition like Buddhism is telling us that we don't have a self as we think of it. So we're wrestling still with not just consciousness, but even who's having the consciousness. Anyway, the next subject I'd like to address, and something you, I think, alluded to this morning, Monica, is that this idea that there's less separation between human beings and the plant and the vegetal world and animals is one that is, of course, you know, in many indigenous traditions, or nearly all of them, the human beings are often seen as just one, you know, species, not superior really, but just part of an ecosystem of species that are all fairly cognitive. So I'm wondering to what extent you think that the scientific work you've done or the things you've researched approach that type of indigenous worldview, and what might still be some of the separations between a scientific way of looking at things and a more shamanic participatory approach to the natural world.
All right. actually, this is an important, there is another keyword that comes up now with this, and is empathy. It's a taboo word in many of the scientific environments that I have experienced because it requires the acknowledgement of a subjectivity, and somehow subjectivity seems to threaten the objectivity of science. And so, but then as you, what has been interesting, and this is like very recently, it's been happening, I have been starting to be a little bit more open about my experiences while I do my science. And the understanding that by being there, I am part of the experiment, so I am a subject of the experimental setup as much as the plant or the animal that I'm looking at. But that doesn't preclude, is not in conflict with the objective method of science. Science is a methodology. is not like a paradigm per se. So within, I can use an objective method, which is scientific, but I must use my subjectivity to try to even vaguely understand what is needed by the other to perform or to be comfortable or to whatever. And so what has been interesting is that whether you talk to people working in labs that are using rats for whatever experiments, or primates, fish, who knows how many other systems, and definitely for myself, plants, it becomes very clear that when you allow yourself to say, you know, I give names to my animals. When I used to work with fish, every single fish had a name. And if it wasn't a name, it was a number, but still the number is identified, this individual specifically, from that one over there. And then you start saying, like, you know, I feel this and that about my fish, or I don't feel, which of course, that's the subjective aspect of the human being that is doing the science. Then it's been really interesting to see how others I've suddenly said, yeah, I had a similar experience with my whatever animal or whatever they are working with. So in fact, what the theme that seems to emerge from this conversation is empathy. And empathy is our weapon as scientists to actually indeed enter or have an entry point to the world and the life of the other, so that we can vaguely understand what it is that they're about and design experiments that allows us then to use an objective method to quantify things. And when you start talking to people, you realize that maybe there are a lot more scientists feeling this way than we are actually acknowledging. So one of the new projects that I'm going to be involved with, you know, some pretty amazing people working on primates and other systems, is to invite openly scientists who have had these very personal and intimate encounters with the other to come forth. Let's collect these stories. You know, scientists, like any other creative endeavor, is about storytelling. You know, we tell the story in a particular way, which is a scientific way of saying, but really, it's another story. And so let's tell those stories and let's bring these animals and these plants and these slime molds and whatever else that we are working with to life, because that's the only way in which we are going to de-objectify them, decolonize them. And actually, it's going to be a collaboration then. It's an encounter between two, and it's a sharing. The experiment becomes a sharing, and the method used for this sharing is the objective method of science, if that's what you choose.
And as you pointed out, I think it's a very good point. And as you pointed out, there's no science without imagination. Exactly. You have to imagine your way to the hypothesis or the experimental idea. As I was listening to you, I think a lot about journalism too, which has these ideals of objectivity. And it's written, if you take, you know, newspaper journalism, as if you can achieve a perfect objectivity. And it's written in this omniscient voice. And like, wait, that's a person talking. They're just pretending to be that way. Obviously, there's a reason they decided to write about this. And we all go into stories, those of us who get to choose our stories, with strong subjective reasons, but because you are subjective and you're passionate about a subject, doesn't mean you can't then follow methods of, in journalism, the equivalent of the scientific method is fairness, mm-hmm. right? That you would report against yourself. You would actually look for people who disagree with you and find the best arguments against your arguments. So I agree that you can give up that conceit, and that's all it is, of existing above any interest, any subjectivity, without giving up the whole game. And that making that distinction, and it really is at the beginning of the process especially, and then you leave it aside, I think that applies to writing as well.
So another
I can't remember if this was actually the answer to your question.
Well, that's all right, you know. This is a leaderless, you know, as Nina was saying, you know, it's a new vision of leadership. Everybody's, that could be chaos, though. I don't know. I might be afraid to open that door. I'm not sure, you know. So another question I have is, do you think that this emerging broader view of the way humans fit into the natural world and a more expansive view of, you know, what smartness in plants and animals could have any effect on the environmental crisis we're having? Because it's somewhat tragic that just as we're becoming more and more open to this idea of the natural world as being alive, that we're destroying more and more of it. So do you think there's any way that this could, you know, that this emerging awareness could help in the environmental movement?
Well, to the extent that, you know, animal welfare and animal rights is part of the environmental movement, it has already, I think. I mean, there are things we, you know, think about the image of elephants in world culture right now. You know, I mean, there's still problems, but we're moving to defend elephants because of a powerful recognition of the complexity of their consciousness and that it becomes beyond the pale now to abuse certain animals. And even in scientific quarters where people are, you know, tormenting rodents routinely, there's a lot of misgiving about it and a lot of politics around it and a lot of effort to deal with it. So I think on the animal side, yeah, we've seen changes. If you go to a more planetary scale, you know, at the same time that kind of consciousness is emerging, this sense of likeness, we're also talking a lot about the Anthropocene and the idea that we are, you know, we have a unique power in nature, and many people are coming around to the point of view that it's going to be human ingenuity that's going to save us from climate change. I mean, even the IPCC report was much more open to geoengineering and some, you know, pretty wild solutions. That so there is a new hubris, perhaps, that's replacing the old hubris. Maybe it's the same hubris, but the scale is planetary. So I'm not sure. I mean, I'd like to be more hopeful about it.
Yeah, even with elephants, I mean, the numbers are still pretty staggering. And one of the main anti-poaching activists was just murdered in Kenya a few months. I mean, so this is definitely not a done deal.
But it's a politics. Oh, it's definitely not a done deal. Yeah. And elephants are disappearing from zoos in this country. That idea, which in my childhood, there was nothing complex about seeing an elephant in a zoo. And now it's kind of unbearable for a lot of people.
Yeah, I was watching TV, just flicking the dials, and there was an old episode of a 77 Sunset Strip from the 60s, and they were on a rhinoceros hunt in Africa. So that we've come a long way on that score anyway.
I'm going to use the Anthropocene as a starting point because, at least in academic circle, that word is just the new word that you write in your grant so that they will give you some funding. It was climate change, but now climate change has got a bad reputation, so you go for Anthropocene. And it looks like you're really serious about making changes. And what I don't like about that word, and I have expressly expressed that even in academia, first of all, it just reiterates exactly the problem, you know, that it's still anthropocentric, it's still all about us. And it's like, yeah, we are part of the problem, but we're not the only, you know, we need to demonize our own self too, because otherwise it's a guilt trip. And a lot of people feel helpless in the situation with climate change because we are so guilt-ridden, which is so patriarchal and still so old. It's exactly the old story, just re-vomiting itself onto us in a different word. And so it makes it, literally, that's what I feel. I feel like it's in my gut. It's like, oh, yuck, bad word, don't use that. But the reason why I think it's bad is because, well, first of all, it's still anthropocentric. So it still places us as, before we were dominion of the world, now we are the problem of the world, and it's always about us. And so it still forget in the picture that there is many other species around with us. And but the other thing is, from conservation psychology, we know, and these are data, we know that when you feel... when you are faced with something that is challenging you and you feel maybe guilty or shame because you feel responsible for it, a little touch of guilt might put you into action and you can do something about it. And so it's healthy. But when the situation is kind of overwhelming, and if this situation is not overwhelming yet, don't worry, it will become even more overwhelming as the time goes by if we don't do anything about it. And so the guilt and the shame become so gigantic, the weight of it pretty much like immobilize you. So guilt and shame will freeze you into the spot where you are. And this is kind of what we've been doing, or, you know, like we have been making the effort of moving forward, but it seems like we're not. And maybe we're frozen because we're looking at the situation as like, you see, we are the bad people doing all these terrible things, which partly we are. But also, and I guess it returns for me to empathy, is like the key is in realizing that we are not alone. This is the human Homo sapiens, self-congratulatory term for like the wise one, is growing possibly, hopefully, towards his own self-fulfilling prophecy of becoming the wise Homo species. But in the meantime, he can learn a lot by connecting to other species that are all around us. And actually, just at lunchtime, I was talking to someone, and it was like, you know, we are, actually it was just before lunch, it was like an elder from Australia said at one point, because I was one of those that thought, oh, if nature could just get rid of us, the planet would be so much better without us, right? That one. And what she said was, well, you know, the earth would cry, whether it was a bacteria disappearing, a giraffe, a human, a plant, a bird. So it's not an hierarchical system where there is someone at the top, whether it's us or someone else's, it doesn't really matter. We're all here together in a circle. And so we are all as important as each other. The quickest we recognize that, and the quicker we'll stop doing some of the activity that we are doing, because our activity are just reflecting that we are totally misguided and misunderstanding our positioning in the collective.
And that was a panel discussion that included Monica Gagliano and Michael Pollan. Michael Pollan, who is the author of The Botany of Desire, and Monica Gagliano, who is the author of Thus Spoke the Plant, a remarkable journey of groundbreaking scientific discoveries and personal encounters with plants. Thanks for listening to the show. That's all the time we have left. You can always email us at equilibrium@ckut.ca. And you can follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/EcoLibriumCKUTMontreal. You can also find our related podcast on Spotify, which is called the Equilibrium Radio Podcast. So thanks for listening. Have a great rest of your day. This is Ryan Young with Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. And we'll leave you with some music. This is a version of Turn, 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 which I believe is a Pete Seeger song. But here it's being covered by Bruce Coburn.
A time to kill, a time to heal, a time under heaven. A time to build up, a time to break down, a time to dance, a time under heaven.
Them fi know you in a man puppy insane a play for the girl and you see it. Downtown sound represent for me ladies.
If you wanna run away with me, I know a galaxy and I can take you for a ride. I had a premonition that we fell into a rhythm where the music don't stop for life. Glitter in the sky, glitter in my eyes, shining just the way I like. If you're feeling like you need a little bit of company, you met me at the perfect time.
One of the greatest, ain't no debating on it. I'm still levitated, I'm heavily medicated. Ironic, I gave him love and they end up hating on me. She told me she loved me and she been waiting. Been fighting hard for your love and I'm running thin on my patience. Needing someone to hug, even took it back to the basement.
Feel the beat!
Wait a minute, that's too fast.
Now what?
Kick it over here, baby pop!
CKUT, yo, yo, this is for your mind. At work, you gotta hear it. In West Indian rhythms on Saturday night. Roots rock reggae, I keep it tight. Man child, hitting switches, keep it right. The cypher on a Friday.